Movie of the Week. Presenting the world premiere of an original motion picture produced especially for ABC. Tonight on the Movie of the Week.
Welcome to the Film and Water Podcast, proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Rob Kelly, and this week we are talking about a TV movie. We haven't covered hardly any TV movies on the show to this point, but this week is a TV movie. It's called Honeymoon with a Stranger, starring the great Janet Leigh from 1969. And basically, if you want to talk about a TV movie, there's really one person you need to talk to. And that is the co-host of the Made for TV Mayhem podcast, Amanda Reyes. Hello, Amanda, and welcome to the show.
Hey, Rob. Thanks so much for having me. I'm super excited to talk about this movie.
I'm really excited to have you here. I'm a big fan of your show. Of course, I got to know you through your co-host and our mutual friend, Dan Budnick.
Correct.
Who has been on the show. And yes. He was the one that tipped me over to your show, the Made for TV Mayhem show. And before we get into this movie specifically, which you recommended I watch, and we will get into all that. Like, I want to explain to everybody, because I think most people listening to this are going to come to it as cold as I did. Like, I, for all the years I've been watching television, you know, which is like 40 years now, I've been watching TV, basically. I always thought of TV movies as kind of like, you know, Richard Chamberlain and Connie Selica in Murder in the Big Top. You know, I mean, like, just stuff like that. I had no idea there was this level of a subculture to them. And the depth of knowledge that you guys have of these movies is astounding. But I just didn't know there were so many covering so many genres. I mean, this is completely all new to me.
That's amazing, and I'm really excited to hear that, and part of the reason why I do what I do. So I've been writing about TV movies for almost a decade for my blog, which is called Made for TV Mayhem. And part of that was not just to have other people sort of either rediscover or discover for the first time some movies, but also for myself, because as a child of the 70s, you know, I came to be on TV movies mostly because our local channel, I grew up in Las Vegas, our local channel played a lot of them on like the Saturday afternoon movies. And like I saw Gargoyles and Don't Be Afraid of the Dark, like ad nauseum. And they were gateways, you know what I mean, for horror for me. So before I was allowed to watch something like Friday the 13th, which I did see at a fairly young age, but still I was really young here, I could sit and watch these really great little monster movies or mysteries or dramas that were really captivating to me. And I don't, you know, when you're 10, you don't recognize it as a TV movie as such, right. But there are these things that are actually considered fairly disposable, and we might talk about that later, sort of like how TV movies came to be, and, you know, they were only meant to air a couple times, so a lot of them are really lost. And I know that something you said to me earlier was sort of like, this is sort of a new world for you, and that's because they basically got sort of forgotten about, literally, you know, as time passed and networks wanted to keep up with current content and local, if local channels even exist, do they really play these anymore? Not really. So it's sort of like a form of lost cinema. And that's kind of where I'm approaching it now.
That's interesting. I use the phrase lost cinema. That's because that's what's kind of got me hooked on this a little, in that, you know, I mean, was like the one we're going to talk about, Honeymoon with a Stranger, it's got Janet Leigh.
Yes.
You know, I mean, it's like, it's not some, you know, Z-grade person that you've never heard of. It's the co-star of Psycho, for Pete's sakes, in the 60s, too. This is 1969. This is only 9 years after Psycho, only 5 years after The Manchurian Candidate. This movie also features Rosanna Brazzi, who I'm familiar with from Summertime, which he did with Katharine Hepburn, which is like my favorite Katharine Hepburn movie. Cesar Danova, who of course I know is the mayor from Animal House. Eric Braeden, who was in a million soap operas, and the Colossus, the Forbin Project, and Escape from Planet of the Apes. And Barbara Steele, the great Barbara Steele, is in this movie. And it's like, when you pointed this one out to me and I looked at the cast, I was like, wow. Like, I had no idea that TV movies went this deep. So, like, in terms of it being, like, when you were growing up and you said, you know, you didn't recognize that, you know, TV movies are any different than regular movies. Like, when did you start to learn that, like, these things were kind of lost cinema? Was that when home video came around and you couldn't find these things again?
Yeah, it was sort of later in life. These movies kind of came and went. And I do want to talk about the star power here in a little bit, because you made me think of something I'd like to bring up. But you know, like a lot of time passed and I sort of forgot about them. They would come up periodically. Like I did not see Bad Ronald, which is a classic TV film, until I was in my mid-20s. And that was because somebody recommended it to me. And I was lucky enough that a video store by my house actually had it. It did have a home video release. Interestingly enough, that movie got stolen. That was one of the most sought after TV movies until Warner Archives recently, the last few years, put it out on their print on demand, I guess is what you call it, movie on demand service. I guess a little over 10 years ago, I had a friend who, I guess over 15 years now, I think about it, he had a fanzine called Debaser. His name is Ryan Orvis. We lived in LA together. We worked at Borders. And he kind of gave me carte blanche to write whatever I wanted to in his fanzine. I wrote about David Warbeck. I wrote this huge essay about David Warbeck. I wrote about like the idiot man child and, you know, horror films, you know, like Hills Have Eyes and stuff like that. And I mean, it was whatever I wanted, right? And so I wrote about soap operas, obviously. I love soap operas. But I did an article where I was going to just write about some TV movies that I thought were worth seeing. And in LA, there's a video store called Eddie Brandt Saturday Matinee. Yes. And they have what's called a loaner list. So what it is that it's a really world famous video store. And actually, if you watch like the end of Quentin Tarantino movies and stuff, a lot of times you'll see Eddie Brandt or Donovan, his son's name in the credits. And so people would donate videos to them and they were just things they taped off television over the years and, or collected, and they weren't allowed to rent them. But if you rented a legitimate video, you could ask for a title on the loaner list. So I used to go there and I used to say, hey, could I get this and Bad Ronald and Women in Chains or whatever? And they would say, okay. And then I started rewatching these movies to write this article. And I picked up like 10 really famous movies. I can't even remember what they were now, but it was like Satan's School for Girls, you know, Don't Be Afraid of the Dark, like the basics. And I was like, these are so good. Why haven't I seen these around more? And then I started collecting them off eBay. At the time, you could buy bootlegs off eBay. And so I picked up like Five Desperate Women, This House Possessed, which I still haven't gotten a great copy of. I have three copies. Each copy gets better to look at. But the first copy I got was almost unwatchable. And that's my all-time favorite TV movie. I watched it the night it aired, and I have a lot of heart for that. But it was almost unwatchable, and I watched that tape like 1,000 times. Like I degraded it way worse than it already was because I loved it so much. And so I was writing about horror movies in LA at the time. I was in a really good place to meet a lot of filmmakers and stuff, but there's a lot of people writing about horror, and it was a lot of, I couldn't keep up with the content. I was working full time, and I was all over the map, and I got really burnt out. And so I decided to start a blog about TV movies, and, it just kind of went from there. And so I realized I haven't written a lot about like the hardcore classics. I have written about Bad Ronald, but like I haven't really written about Dark Knight of the Scarecrow for my blog. I have written about it, but I find that even in TV movies, which is obscure to begin with, I'm even more interested in the obscura inside the obscura. So I've actually been looking for movies like Honeymoon with a Stranger for years, because they were like full on lost. Like there was a movie that we covered on our show called Women in Chains. This is where I get back to like the star system and how these movies, it's so strange that they've disappeared. So we covered a movie called Women in Chains along with Born Innocent, because we were doing like a woman in prison thing. And I wanted to pair Born Innocent with something a lot lighter, because that's a very heavy film. And Women in Chains was, for many years, up until the late 80s, in the top 20 highest-rated original made-for-TV movies to ever air on television. And it originally aired in 1972, so almost 20 years had passed, and it was still in the top 20 most-watched films, along with, like, Night Stalker. And it over half the country, or almost half the country, watched it the night it aired. It starred Ida Lupino. It also had Lois Nettleton in it. Belinda Montgomery had a really good cast.
That's a hell of a list of people you just rattled off like that.
Yeah, and they're great in it. It's campy, it's fun, but it's totally disappeared. Like nobody, you never hear anybody talk about it. Yet at some point, like 40 million televisions were tuned into Women in Chains than I did originally aired, and now it's gone. So you hear about like a handful of movies all the time. Like Dark Knight of the Scarecrow is a big one you always hear about. Bad Ronald would be another one. Don't Be Afraid of the Dark. Those are classics of genre TV movies. But then there's things like Women in Chains that are just gone. Yet if you were alive in 1972 and old enough to watch something, you were probably watching Women in Chains. So what happened to this film? I don't know, right? So this goes back to that idea that they're like disposable cinema. So, you know, they were made to air once or twice on the network. And then if your local programmer wanted it, they would get a copy of it. I'm assuming on 60 millimeter. People have been asking me what kind of stock it comes in. I don't really know, but I think it's 16 because there's a lot of 16 millimeter prints of TV movies floating around on eBay. So I'm guessing that's what, where they came from. And so your local programmer would play it. And if you were lucky, then you could see it there a couple more times. But it was really kind of disposable cinema. But it had a cachet to it because it had people like Ida Lupino or this movie that we're going to talk about with Janet Leigh. And yet, who knows what happened to them. So I recently just interviewed Lance Guest for we're going to be doing an after-school special on my podcast. And my blog is going to host an interview with Lance Guest, who's best known, you know, for Halloween 2 and Last Starfighter. But when I originally reached out to him and said, would you like to talk about your after-school specials and maybe some of your other TV work? He sent me back an email and he said, nobody ever asks me about these. Please ask me. He didn't say please, but he was like, just fire away whatever you want to ask. So I'm like, hey, what was it like working on Lou Grant? You know what I mean? Because he just wanted to talk about these things. And I actually met Amanda Weiss, who's in This House Possessed, in the opening scene. And she signed, I have a This House Possessed script, and she signed it for me. And we were talking about it, and she was so excited that people had heard of this movie. She was promoting, you know, Nightmare on Elm Street at a convention. And she loves to talk about that movie, and she loves her fans. But her TV movie work and her after-school special work had never been talked about before. And she was dying to tell me, and I wish I could remember the name of it. I didn't write it down. She did a movie where her after-school special where her mom plays an alcoholic. And she won an award for that. And nobody ever brings it up. And she's really proud of the work she did for that. So they, not only is it lost cinema, but the people in these movies are like, oh, my God, yes, I made that, and I really enjoyed it, and this happened, and I thought it was a really good story, and it just kind of disappeared. And so that's kind of the sad part of the TV movie for me.
Yeah, you mentioned when you talk about the size of the audience, you know, I mean, people that are younger than us, I think you and I are probably around the same age, I'm probably a little older, but we probably grew up around the same time, is people that are younger forget the idea that, you know, if something aired on network television in the 70s, and if it was, say, the number one show that night, that was probably a 40 share. That was probably tens of millions of people. And now there is no show on television at all, except maybe like a football game that gets tens of millions of people watching it all at the same time, because we're all so splintered and there's just so many channels. And so it is really interesting thing to consider that they would make a movie, any network would make a movie meant to be disposable, yet it gets 30 million people watching it. I mean, if you made something that made 30 million today, your career would be set. And yet these things were made with all the same, I guess, you know, not maybe not the same level of budget, but pretty close, you know, the same care, the same level of you know, artistry that any other movie would be made of. And then they're just forgotten. They're just, you know, now generally, I know this may be hard to answer because it's probably different cases in every single movie, but who generally owns these things? Are they the network, or are they the production company? I mean, is 20th Century Fox sitting on Honeymoon with a Stranger in a vault somewhere, and or is it a network thing, or I guess it does it depend?
You know, my understanding is that a lot of these TV movies were co-produced between the network and a studio. A lot of times it was Universal Studios in the case of ABC Movie of the Week. Not always, though. I know you said 20th Century Fox, and that I guess that's the case with Honeymoon with a Stranger, but a lot of times they did Universal co-productions. And it's my understanding that it's the studio that has probably the majority of them, but you're right, I don't know for sure, but I'm basing that off of like who releases these movies. And so, like, you know, Warner Archive comes from Warner Brothers, and they're releasing movies. And I think, I don't know if it was Universal, somebody else released a couple of TV movies on this sort of movie on demand service.
Right.
Recently, and I know Universal I live here in Austin, and they have a television symposium here every year. And I went to the first one here when I moved here 3 years ago, and somebody from Universal was here, a couple people, and they were talking about TV movies. Well, I asked them, that's why they were talking about it. And, they own a bunch, and they were looking at putting them on television, but I don't know whatever became of that. I was hoping that maybe there would be a DVD release, but they were aware of what they had, their library, and that they were looking to explore what to do with it. So I do think, based on that information, I would say that it mostly resides within the studio system and not with the networks per se.
It's amazing to think, again, what's out there. Like, I'm such a movie nerd that sometimes I will go to IMDb and I'll just kind of troll around looking at things,
right.
I'll just follow links, you know, like, oh, the Robert Mitchum, blah, blah, blah. And like a couple of months ago, my girlfriend and I are huge fans of Robert Mitchum. and we like movies with, like, he did a couple movies with Deborah Carr, and we were like, oh, okay, let me see. And I knew that they had done Heaven Knows Mr. Allison. That's the movie we know. And then I was like, oh, what else have they done together? They knew they did other movies. I was like, oh, The Grass is Greener with Cary Grant. I'm familiar with that one. Oh, The Sundowners. I haven't seen, I've heard of it, but I've never seen that one. Let's rent this. And then there was a fourth movie in the 80s that they did together. And I was like, what's this? And it was this movie called Reunion at Fairborough or something. And it's a TV movie.
Oh.
And I literally had never heard of it. And I it's on YouTube. The whole thing is on YouTube. And so we just, why it was, you know, it was utterly delightful. And I never, literally never heard. I thought I heard of every Robert Mitchum movie, but this one just completely flew under the radar. And so again, it was another one of those things where I'm like, ah, this is, for some reason, these TV movies, they're made, they're shot. I mean, again, couldn't have a bigger movie stars than Robert Mitchum and Deborah Carr, made for television, but then it's just, it just disappears down the memory hole. And that yeah, is utterly fascinating. And so that's why I like your guys' show so much, even though I have seen probably 0.1% of the movies you're talking about. I still find it interesting because it really is like this pop culture archaeology. And the one TV movie that I would say I'm like a fan of is that movie Ants, which is the one I had Dan Budnick on to talk
yes,
about.
Yes, it was fun.
Right, and the only reason I even know about it is because it was released on VHS, and we had it at my video store that I worked at. And I was like, I remember scanning the shelves one day, and I went, Ants? Is this that movie Ants? And there it was. And it's like, if that movie had never been put on VHS by some low-rent company, I probably would have completely forgotten about it. So I love the fact that Warner Archive and these other companies, and of course Shout Factory, which we'll get to later on in the show, is finding that there's a market for these things. It's really fascinating.
Yeah, it's really great. And I feel like part of it comes from, you know, we were talking about lost cinema, but I feel like when everything is at your fingertips, there's this whole sort of medium that hasn't really been tapped yet. And yes, there's a lot of stuff available online illegally that's just been put up. And I thank God for that, even though I don't really necessarily promote it, but I wouldn't be able to see a lot of things without stuff like YouTube. But I feel like true cinephiles are like, well, there were over 5,000 movies released between 1964 and 1999 for television. So that
let's say that number again.
It was over 5,000 titles produced. Yes. And I mean, going into cable, I think at that point, because the USA Original, I don't know if you're familiar with that, but the USA Network used to produce a lot of original content. And a lot of those TV movies are really good. They're old school. They came out in the 90s, but they heavily reach back into the 70s for a lot of, like, The Haunting of Sarah Hardy, I think is the name of it, is like, it could have come out in the 70s. And they're really good. So they produced over 200 movies, I think, in a decade. So that just shows you kind of the output. And that was for basic cable. So imagine when we're a network, and at the time networks had a lot more money
right, sure.
To do that kind of stuff. So, and up until, like, I guess from like 1969, when the ABC Movie of the Week premiered, to the mid 70s, there was an original made for television movie probably airing every night during the TV season on a different network. So all the networks started kicking in after, because the ABC Movie of the Week was so huge. CBS and NBC followed suit. And so by the time you got to like 74, every night of the week, there was some sort of original telefilm on. And so just in those few years, they were producing a couple hundred titles a year, you know, so it adds up, And so it's kind of, and there's so many movies I just can't find. And, you know, and I, like, I'm really looking for them and they're just gone. And so if I'm looking for them, I know cinephiles, they think, oh my gosh, look at, there's just this whole hotbed of titles I've never heard of. And there's so many good titles in there, and somebody's going to root them out, you know what I mean? And find them for me. So that's the good part.
Do you have any theories as to why they kind of died out? Like, they're really not a thing much anymore, except like maybe Lifetime. And I even think like the Lifetime ones are probably, you know, they're kind of maybe, I don't know, I don't want to say they're a joke, but there's kind of a joke of like, you know, the Mother May I Sleep With Danger kind of thing, where it's
so good.
They're
yeah,
sort of overwrought women in danger things. Do you think there's a reason why they just sort of faded out over time? Well,
that's actually interesting that you would bring up that in particular, because just briefly, I want to talk about when the TV movie originally came out. Now, there's all different kinds of TV movies with all different kinds of people in them doing all kinds of different things. But in general, the TV movie marketed their films to The Housewife. Women aged 18 to 49 were the prime target for TV movies, and that's because they were the housewife and they were the largest consumer in the household. So advertisers wanted women to watch their shows. So I'm not surprised that by the 90s it sort of devolved into, like you said, Mother May I Sleep with Danger, which I said was so good, but it's really not. It's my least favorite of Tori Spelling. Au revoir. And I love Tori Spelling. And we did a Tori Spelling episode and we talked about two really good ones. But so that's kind of part of it. I just want to address that. So like, they're very female centric, but what's so interesting about TV movies is it's mostly men I find that are interested in them, yet they were originally made for women. So that's an interesting, I don't know why that is exactly, but maybe because they featured a lot of really interesting women that men like, I don't know. But, if you look at, and it's in my book, which is called Are You in the House Alone? A TV Movie Compendium. So I split up the reviews by decade. Well, I started in the 60s and then went to 79, and then it goes from 80 to 89 and then 90 to 99. And at the beginning of every review section, I put a little page in there about what was sort of prominent in that decade in terms of what kind of TV movies are being produced. And so the 70s was a huge horror output, and I'm not exactly sure why that is, except that they were popular, so people just decided to keep producing them. But by the 90s, you did get it, they kind of got rid of the horror element, and it became more like the disease of the week became really popular. Docudramas were huge. Reunion movies were really popular. Those are wonderful. And these women in peril films, but they were different than the women in peril films in the 70s, and not just in the way that they were written, because I feel like in the 70s they were maybe a little bit more complex, but the budgets were also getting chopped because the networks were also not having as much money because of cable and things like that. I'm trying to think what the second part of my answer was to that. Well, so part of it was budgetary and the lack of savvy in like, well, we want to attract women to these films, so let's do a Mother May I Sleep with Danger. And what's really interesting is they did, we talked about it on my podcast, I think it's called Death of a Cheerleader. It's a Tori Spelling movie, also known as A Friend to Die For, which was a huge TV movie when it aired in like 1994 or 96. I can't remember which year it was. And what they did with that film is that, so TV movies that were concentrated on sort of the women in peril in the 90s were really focusing on the adult woman in peril. She was usually a mother, usually a wife, because they thought that those types of women would still be watching these films. But they decided, whoever the woman who produced it was, and it was one of, I think it was the first film she produced with Aaron Spelling or whoever, it wasn't Aaron Spelling, whoever produced the movie, it was NBC. And she said, let's switch the point of view and position it in the daughter's point of view. And so they took the mother, who was Valerie Harper, and they made her sort of a side character. And then they took Kelly Martin, who plays the daughter, and they made the movie about her. And it ended up being huge. So then after that, you saw a lot of movies where the younger woman was the woman facing the problem. And Shannon Doherty did a lot of them. She did a really good one called Friends Till the End, which is a really good sort of single white female ripoff. And so it was interesting. So they were finding different ways to position the woman to get viewers, but I think they sort of lost what made the heyday of the film so glorious, and that was the, sort of the nuance and the complexity of those movies. And I'm just writing an essay right now for somebody about female ensemble pieces in early television horror films, like Five Desperate Women, which we covered, something called Do Not Fold, Spindle, or Mutilate, which is about four older women. It's like the Golden Girls.
Myrna Loy's in that, right?
Yes, yes.
I've always wanted to see it because Myrna Loy's in it, and I've never been able to find it.
It's amazing. It's amazing. It's like one of my favorite movies.
Wow.
Home for the Holidays is a real popular one that everybody knows. And then that kind of followed into the 80s. But so in the 70s, when they were trying to make these, so I think when they were making horror movies with these ensembles, they were trying to figure out how to attract a male audience. So they made a horror film. And then they were putting ensemble female cast together, which attracted the female audience member. Those two together were made really highly viewed films. Like Five Desperate Women, I think, did really well when it came out in the Nielsen. So like they were doing different things to get the female viewer in that. And then in the 80s, they were still doing the same work, but they were doing it with like The Burning Bed. I guess you were doing it in the 70s with The Case of Rape, but there was a lot of things in the 80s that got addressed that needed to in films that were really well done, usually starring Farrah Fawcett, it turned out. they sort of switched gears. They dropped the horror, but they were still keeping the focus on the female. And here they started developing different ideas. There was a more of a realism maybe to them. And then by the 90s, I don't know what they were thinking. I think a lot of those erotic thrillers were really popular. And so there was a lot of attempts at those. And, you know, you had to drop the eroticism, but they had really fun movies. Like there's one called The Face of Fear. I think that's the name of it, with Tracy Gold. Where she's basically just like kill somebody to like go undercover. I think she killed her boyfriend, and then she kills somebody to take their place at a college. They're on their way to a college, and then she assumes that role of that girl, and she falls in love with her roommate's father, played by Perry King. And that's a really fun movie. And so they were sort of like trying to like mix different things together. It's just that I just feel like maybe they just weren't given the same time and budget and thought as maybe the early film. That's not to denounce them. I love a lot of movies that came out in the 90s. I think they're underrated, but that you have to watch them differently, I think, than you would. So when we talk about Honeymoon with a Stranger, you'll see that it has a very cinematic quality to it. And a lot of the early 70s and late 60s TV movies had that quality. As you go on, they become really flat and static. Mm-hmm. Visually, and you can tell that they're a TV movie just by the aesthetics. In the 60s and 70s, I'm not sure you could, except that you can see where the commercial breaks are.
Right.
Do you know
right.
what I mean?
Yeah. Well, that's a perfect segue to talk about Honeymoon with a Stranger, because, you know, obviously, if you're shooting a thriller, which this is, and you're doing it for television, you have to probably be extra creative, because you can't rely on extreme violence, you can't rely on any sort of language, you can't rely on certainly any nudity. All the things that, you know, if you're making like a giallo thriller, you could do. If you're Mario Bava or something, you could
right.
do all these things. But they don't, you know, here the director, John Pizer,
yes.
You know, he's not able to do that. So you probably have to be a little bit extra creative to get across this story. And the this movie has a very interesting shift halfway through the movie. And for once, I'm not going to reveal it. Normally on this show, I'm perfectly comfortable giving away spoilers, because most of the movies we talk about are old. And, you know, to me, I'm like, anything past a year is the sell-by date for spoilers. But this movie is on YouTube, entirety. We'll have the links to it in the show notes. And so, and I think a lot of the pleasure comes from you literally don't know what's about to happen. So we are going to do our best to not talk about anything spoilery. So basically the intro of the story is this. Sandra Latham, played by Janet Leigh, is an American woman honeymooning with her wealthy new husband, Ernesto, played by Joseph Lindsay, at his Spanish villa. But the next morning, Sandra awakens only to be confronted with a stranger, Cesar de Nova, who insists that he is her husband. She goes to the authorities, who, unfortunately, believe the stranger's story, and so Sandra begins a frenzied search for her new husband. When her sister-in-law, Carla, played by Barbara Steele, arrives accompanied by a totally different man who claims he's Ernesto, Sandra begins fearing for her own sanity. And that is the basic setup to this movie. The first thing, the first frame of this movie, which is the title, it charmed me because it's using the same font as the Batman TV show. And that's why it makes me think they're both from 20th Century Fox. So they must have had that font just like on hand and they're looking to use it. But this is, you know, this is not a movie shot on some back lot. This is clearly shot on location, you know, in Italy and stuff like that. And you see a lot of these beautiful locations. And this is a fun little thriller with a really terrific performance by Janet Leigh. So, like, why did you recommend this one to me when I asked you, like, what, you know, out of all the ones to sort of pick from?
Well, this movie is one I've been searching for a long, long time for. It had been on my radar. I didn't know much about it except that it was in a book I had with a very short capsule review. And I was like, this looks really interesting to me and I would like to see it. And it kind of appeared on YouTube, well, I don't know, like a year ago maybe. And I sat down and watched it just, I don't know, 2 or 3 months ago. And I would, like you, I was really charmed by it. And I'm just starting to get into the 60s TV movies. I kind of write a lot about the 70s, but the very beginnings of the TV movie are a lot different to me, the ones I can find. They really feel cinematic and they have an international flavor to them. There's a movie called The Smugglers with Shirley Booth and Carol Lynley. And also Donnelly Rhodes is in it as a Frenchman. He's amazing. And I couldn't believe how handsome he was. He looks so good. That one takes place, I think, in Italy. And And then there's another one called How I Spent My Summer Vacation with Robert Wagner, which is just an international, I think it starts in France, and it's like a spy thriller kind of thing, but a comedy too. And these are like really strange anomalies to me. These are like different. By like the time the ABC Movie of the Week started, which this was a part of, there's not a huge amount of films that have this kind of flavor, but they do have the same feeling of cinema. And I just thought, you know, this is a movie I'd like to do something with. And I wanted to review it, but I've been so busy, I haven't been able to blog the way I want to. And so when you asked if I could recommend a movie, this was just one that had been on my mind. And I thought this might be really fun because it's kind of unusual. It's mostly unheard of, and I think it's worthy of discovering. And I was really glad that you liked it because I thought it would be fun to have a conversation about.
Oh, I did. I mean, it's Janet Leigh. I mean, it's Janet Leigh. You know, it's terrific. Yeah. And it's Janet Leigh in her prime. She's 42 here. She looks terrific. She gets a bunch of really great outfits to wear.
Yes, yes.
I mean, there's a costume she wears at the end where she looks like a Little Orphan Annie. It's like this red dress with white piping, and I'm like, she looks like an oversized Little Orphan Annie. But I mean, she's terrific in this. And like, you know, was this kind of, in terms of being a TV movie, was this like a, I'm guessing this was not considered like a come down, right? For a theater, for a movie actress, this was just kind of like, you know, it was something she could do, and it was probably a fun trip. You know, she got to go to Italy. She got to bring her daughter. Apparently, this movie is the cinematic debut of Jamie Lee Curtis in a crowd scene. I was not able to find her. But apparently there's some crowd scene where you see there's like a 9-year-old Jamie Lee Curtis somewhere. I could not pick her up. But,
that's, you know, amazing.
I'm picturing, you know, it's you go to Janet Leigh and you say, hey, you're going to be the star of this movie. You're going to get to be in virtually every scene. You get to do a lot of interesting stuff. Plot wise, it gives you a nice change up, and you get to bring your daughter, you know, like a paid vacation. Like, why wouldn't you go and shoot something? This sounds terrific.
Yeah, there was though. There was even in the '70s, sort of a, oh, you're doing a TV movie kind of thing. It was already sort of maligned. I do agree with you about this. And this one does definitely have a quality to it that, makes it feel bigger than it is. And I don't know that Janet Leigh ever didn't like working. She did another movie later called The House on Green Apple Road, which is one of Dan's, my podcasting partner's, favorite TV movies, and she's amazing in that as well. But Olivia de Havilland did The Screaming Woman, which was, I believe, another ABC Movie of the Week, and with Walter Pidgeon and Joseph Cotten, I believe,
wow,
are in it.
That's a great group of actors you just read. Again, that's amazing.
Yes, and Ed Nelson, who's one of my favorites from Peyton Place. And when that movie came out, there was a lot of press for it because it was Olivia de Havilland's first TV movie, and it might be her only one, I can't remember. And maybe it's not, don't quote me on that. But they were all like, well, this is where the work is. And she was, it was like the newspaper reports were very like, not insulting, but there was definitely like, oh, look, they're doing TV now. So it already had a stigma to it. And but I don't know that the actors necessarily cared because it's work. And Olivia de Havilland said in an interview that she really enjoyed doing it because it was kind of a different character for her. And it was, and also to work with Walter Pidgeon and Joseph Cotten was, and I think she did a Love Boat with Joseph Cotten later, but Aaron Spelling was really into classic actors. He really felt like they got treated really poorly. And Janet Leigh was in her 40s. So already there's this idea that when you're an actress of a certain age,
right,
it's hard to get the kind of roles that she's being offered on television. And here she's very sexy, very beautiful, smart, and it's a terrific performance. And she's got men all over her, right? And you know, so you're right. Like, she's not going to get that chance maybe in a theatrical, but here she gets a chance to really shine. And you'll see a lot of actors use television as a platform for that. So even though there's this general idea in the industry that you're being looked down on, for actors, especially actors, TV actors like Elizabeth Montgomery is a great example, and Andy Griffith, who want to play characters that were so different from what they were known for, TV was a really great venue for that. And so for somebody like Janet Leigh or for Olivia de Havilland, it gave them a chance to carry a film on their back, you know, and shine. And also Do Not Fold, Spend, or Mutilate is all about giving the spotlight to four really wonderful actresses who happen to be women of a certain age. They're amazing in it. So yeah, this was a really good venue for her. And you know what? I'm in love with Rosanna Brazzi in this movie. So I'm not surprised that she would take a role to be even near him, because to me, it looked like the prototype for what would become Robert Forster later in his career, mixed with Columbo. Like, that's what I see when I, Rosanna Brazzi is so warm and charming in this film that, like, he just steals every scene that he's in. And to be with Janet Leigh like that, I mean, I can just imagine how much fun it was to make the movie with these amazing actors.
Right, these sort of, you know, European handsome guys. You know, it's funny you mentioned that, you know, these were originally done mostly for housewives, you know, because it was, yes, that was the audience. And I have to think that watching this movie, because the first, you know, I'd say 2/3 of this movie, maybe a little less, is basically one man after the next telling Janet Leigh that she's hysterical, she's nuts, you know, you don't know what you're – and I have to think that that would resonate with women. It would resonate with women back then. I'm sure it resonates with women now. The idea of, you know, this is basically like mansplaining the movie, you know, because it's all these, yeah, guys just saying, oh, no, no, no. This is clearly, this is your husband. What are you talking about? And we know that it's not her husband because we've seen it. We've seen that it's, there's Ernesto one and Ernesto two. And so we know that she's not crazy, but you have all these men just saying, oh, now tut, 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 you know, you're just being hysterical. So I have to think that just that, you know, if you're a woman watching this and you've got a creep of a husband, you're going, you're probably like, yeah, sister, you know, because you feel for Janet Leigh.
You know what? That was a prime thing in these movies. And so interesting, because another movie that Dan likes is called She Cried Murder with Linda Day George. And I always go back to this movie when we talk about the female hysteria trope that is so common in the 70s. And so she witnesses Telly Savalas push somebody onto the train tracks in a subway train, and she calls the police, and the police come, and one of the cops is Telly Savalas. Ah. And so she's like, I didn't see anything. I don't know what I'm talking about. So she's with this woman, Kate Reed, I think is the actress. And she goes aside to the police and she's like, you know, she just lost her husband and she's not feeling right. And it's like this, you're not believable because you're a beautiful woman who, you know, you can't be trusted. Right. And so that is a common occurrence in a lot of movies in general of this era. And you're right. I think there's a subversive element there. In that they've made it in a way that we know it, like in that film, we also saw Telly Savalas commit the murder, and we know she's not crazy, but everybody's playing it like she's kind of an idiot because her husband died and she can't think straight or whatever. And then sometimes TV movies would do something really powerful with that. So there was a movie called Night Cries with Susan St. James and Michael Parks. Oh, Michael Parks. I love him so much. And so she has a baby that quote unquote dies at childbirth, and she has to go about her life, and she keeps having these dreams of this baby crying. And she has a feeling that the baby is somewhere in this world and she needs to find it. And it's kind of a paranormal kind of TV movie. It's got a lot of dream sequences. But the whole point is that she's right. Mm-hmm. Their baby is out there. And all these men, like the guy who played Cannon, William Conrad, I think, he's giving her all this Freudian kind of theory, you know, and he's like her therapist or whatever. And Michael Parks is her husband and he doesn't really believe her. And in the end, we find out that her baby really is still alive. And so you're right. There's like an empowerment in there, in that these women get treated a certain way for a portion of the film. And in the end, they're correct. Right. They were right all along, and they become their own heroes in a lot of ways.
Right. What's his name? I'm blanking on his name. Rosanna Brazzi. He's on her side for the most part. I mean, he's a nice guy, but she really is driving her own plot here. Because again, everyone's against her. Eric Braeden shows up. The very smooth Eric Braeden.
Yes, comes in. So good.
And then Barbara Steele, who wears the most amazing sunglasses in this movie. She has these lenses that are like the size of, I don't, you know, it's like saucer plates. You know. They're unbelievably fashionable, and she looks fabulous. She just looks like $100. And again, everyone looks like they're having a good time because they're in Italy. It's sunny all the time. Everybody's outside. There's a lot of scenes of people outside or having dinners outside. They're having wine outside. I mean, it looks like, you know, everyone just sort of living these fabulous lives. Nobody, except for Brazzi, no one seems to have a job. They're all just kind of like, I mean, you know, because we know that she married a rich guy. So everyone's just sort of living these amazing, fabulous lifestyles. And I do like some of the sort of grittier details where we talked about earlier. Like when we get to the villa for the first time, we see her new husband's villa. And he's got a handyman that works there who's blind, but he is always hovering in the frame. And there's a part where the two of them, where Janet Leigh and her first husband are canoodling, and like we look over and he's watching them, and he's kind of got this like kind of like, you know, and she's of course creeped out. She's like, you know, can you get him to leave? And he's like, he's blind. He can't see anything. But that just gives. I mean, I don't want to oversell it. It's not like it's, you know, really gritty, but it just gives this kind of movie just an extra little detail of weirdness that, again, I didn't expect coming out of a TV movie.
Yeah. Yeah. I just, what always gets me about this film is just how, so a lot of TV movies, and actually I watched this for the first time a few months ago with a movie called The Astronaut, which is with Monty Markham and Susan Clark. And The Astronaut's a really interesting movie because it starts with like a government conspiracy. It's like Capricorn One. It's like something happens on a mission. So they do this whole sort of conspiracy to cover it up because they're trying to keep the space mission going, like the funding from the government. And so this guy dies on his way to Mars or his way back, and they get a doppelganger, and they get him to like learn how to be like the other guy. And then they bring him home, and his wife is Susan Clark, and she's pregnant. And I feel like she loses her baby, and he was going to divorce her anyway. And then this guy shows up, and he's completely different than her original husband. He's actually really loving and sweet, and they fall in love. But the first 15 minutes of the film are building up this government conspiracy, and it's got like the guy on Mars, you know, I've landed on Mars. Oh no, I'm going to die. And then they have the whole government thing. But then a huge portion of the movie, maybe 40 to 50 minutes of it, takes place inside the house. And so it's a really cool movie. I like it. It's a total drama. You have to really be into that. It's a romance, you know. But it's a very statically shot film, and that's kind of more what I'm used to with TV movies. But this movie is so epic in its scope in terms of the cinematography and the location shoots, which were in Italy and in Madrid, Spain. And it's so beautifully shot and large, like that – it just looks different to me, and it's bigger. And I think it's captivating in that way. Because, and the movies that I talked about earlier, The Smugglers and How I Spent My Summer Vacation, are equally like that. That's not necessarily the norm with TV movies, but it is something that can happen. And it gives it a real filmic quality that I really appreciate in this particular film.
Yeah. I also think it's very well paced too, because, you know, typically movies where, you know, the main character is being told you're crazy, you're nuts, and you as the audience member, you know that they're not. You kind of have a shot clock for that, for how long you're going to put up with that, till you kind of get like, all right, come on, let me know what really is going on. And this movie, I think it hits, it does a nice turn right at the moment you would want it to, I would say. You know, like right where you're kind of like, okay, please let me in on what's going on here, because I know Janet Leigh is being duped. So what's happening? And then they do give you this turn, which I really like. I think that's, you know, the movie's 87 minutes. I mean, it's basically, I'm sure, 2 hours, and then it had commercials in it. But it has a nice, it's paced well. You know, it really doesn't wear out its welcome in terms of the plot elements, because you're like, okay, you know. Let me find out what's going on here. And so when we get that turn, it's really kind of nice. And I said, you know, I've seen 1,000 movies at this point, and I didn't really necessarily see where this was going. You know, because anytime Barbara Steele's in a movie, you're kind of like, well, she's probably the bad guy. I don't know. She might be, you know, I mean, she's, you know, and then when they do the turn, you're like, oh, wow, that was a nice little thing. And then there's kind of like even another turn on top of that, which I thought was really interesting. And it's I like all the details that again, we're not going to get into the revealing anything particular, but like when we see at the end how certain things were done, and we get into the descriptions of, you know, how this particular criminal act was taking place. I think that's really interesting. I like the flashbacks. That's got a very Giallo feel to it, where we're flashing back and we're re-showing you what we've already seen, but you see it in a different context. That's a really interesting idea. And you mentioned all the sets. I mean, there's a great scene with Janet Leigh and Brazzi where they're walking like on these ruins, and you're like, you know, that's you know, that what they call that, the production value. You know, I mean, that's something we don't have in America outside of, you know, the Grand Canyon or something. Some, you know, big national monument. Hitchcock made a lot of use of national monuments to put his scenes. But I mean, in Europe, they got those things all over the place. And so it's like a nice, you know, you're these people are in real, like, vacation settings where you could go with your family, I guess, if you were kind of well-heeled. But for the most part, this is something you could do. And here are all these people playing out this incredibly lurid story. I thought it was, you know, really well done. This, the Joseph Pizer guy, or John Pizer, excuse me, he didn't really do too many movies. I looked at his career.
No.
He mostly did television. But, I mean, I thought he was showed a, you know, decent facility for maintaining mood.
I agree. And I like that you brought up the giallo aspect, because that's exactly what it is. It capitalizes on – so I was reading about the giallo, which I love the giallo, but I'm not as familiar with it as I should be. I've seen a lot of the really famous ones, but I haven't gone deep into it yet. It's somewhere I want to go. But something I read online was that the giallo is really – so the giallo, and I'm sure most people listening know that it was basically – they were novels first, right, with the yellow spine, and that's where the word came from. And
That's where it comes from?
Yeah, I believe so, because you could find the book on the shelf because it had the yellow spine, and then you knew you were getting this kind of like police procedural kind of mystery sort of thing. And then when they were made into movies, they became a little different. And somebody had written, and I wish I'd written down the name of the website, but they were kind of breaking down what a giallo was. And they called the giallo film a conceptual framework. And what makes that so good for television is that you can tailor it to your needs. So when we think of giallos, we obviously think of movies with a lot of nudity and a lot of crazy sex and a lot of murder, but there's still other elements that could be used for television, such as the police procedural, which is in almost all giallos, or certainly a lot of them, the glamorous locations, the high fashion, an international cast, and of course the mystery element. And so they took the core of the giallo as it was known then in Italy, and they sort of played with it and figured out how they could do it for television. And I thought they did a really good job, because when I watch it, I clearly, like you, use the word giallo to describe it. So I don't know if they sat down and said, let's make a giallo, or if it was even called that back then. But I feel like the screenwriters, David Harmon and Henry Slessor, knew what they were doing. Now, this is actually based on a French play, and I'm going to mess up the title, but it was like Piège pour un homme seul, which translates into Trap for a Man Alone. And I don't know what the original play looked like, but I really feel like they tailored it really well for television. And it turned out this play was remade into a TV movie 3 times. So there's this, which is the first version. Then there's one that came out, I think, in the mid-70s with Jack Klugman, called One of My Wives is Missing, with Elizabeth Ashley and James Franciscus. And that's a really good movie. Now, it's been a long time since I've seen it, but something about that movie that I like, you were talking about how this movie is really well-paced. It's very brisk. Something that One of My Wives is Missing really stood out to me was that the way they tailored it was that there should be sort of a cliffhanger at every commercial break.
Right.
So something happens every like 15 minutes in the film. There's like this dun, dun, dun. And then you can see where the screen fades and you know the commercial's there. Now, this did get a video release, so you could rent it. It's probably available somewhere else online or on, I don't know if it got a DVD release. And then it was remade again with Margot Kidder, I believe, in the 80s. And it was called Vanishing Act, I think. And now I have that on VHS, but I've never seen it. And I only came across this information because I think I Googled Honeymoon with a Stranger and Vanishing Act came up. And then I saw it was attached on IMDb as a movie connection and said it was remade as this. And whoever wrote that article about Vanishing Act said that it was their favorite TV movie. So I'm really intrigued to see it. It did also get a VHS release. The only one that didn't get a home video release is this one, which is ironic, I guess, because it was the first. But so this was a very popular play that I guess filmmakers felt that they could really work in the television format. And they did a really, really good job here. One of My Wives is Missing is totally different. I feel like it takes place in the mountains in the United States and doesn't have the same sort of grand locale shoots. But it does have Jack Klugman. So
okay, that's a plus. It's always a plus.
It's a definite plus. He's really charming in it. That's what I remember most about it. And I think he's in the Rosanna Brazzi character part.
Okay. Before we get off this, you mentioned the writers, and one of them, David P. Harmon. Two of his other credits are Rescue from Gilligan's Island and the Harlem Globetrotters on Gilligan's Island. So that's a guy that sort of took one in the teeth for his art, you know. He had to write those things.
Well, you know,
he had to write dialogue for the Harlem Globetrotters.
There's art in there too. I'm sure I could find it if I had to. I know I haven't seen those in years either, but I remember Tom Bosley is in one of them, and I loved it. I think it might be Rescue from Gilligan's Island. I can't remember. But those were those were huge in my childhood. I remember those played all the time on television.
Oh yeah, they're a big deal. So yeah, I think this is like a terrific little movie. Again, I don't want to oversell it. It's not I'm calling it. Maybe I'm mispronouncing. Maybe it's. I'm saying giallo. Maybe it is giallo. I don't know. I've never actually heard the word out.
Yeah, I never say it right. Okay. Don't quote me. Ask Dan, because Dan I think was trying to train me how to say it, and I kept like rebelling, because we did proto slashers, and we did a movie called She's Dressed to Kill, but She's Dressed to Kill is really a giallo or giallo. But I was calling it a proto slasher because I was trying to fit two films together.
Okay.
But it really works as giallo or giallo, better.
Right. Yeah. So I don't want to oversell it. This is not the bird with the crystal plumage or anything like that, but it's for someone who's a noob like me on TV movies, I really was going into this completely blind. And as I watched it, I was really sort of impressed. And again, the cast is just fun to watch, just looking at Janet Leigh in her prime and Barbara Steele looking just unfathomably gorgeous, and Eric Braeden with his hair and everything, and that deep, sonorous voice that he had. This is a really enjoyable little thriller. Again, it's on YouTube. You can watch the whole thing for free. It's a lot of fun. It really is a lot of fun. So I'm really glad that you recommended it. And thank you for... again, telling me to watch it, because I had a lot of fun.
Yeah, thank you so much for bringing me on to talk about it, because I've been dying to talk about it for like the last few months, and so it's been nice to have like a venue to have a discussion over it.
Fantastic. Now, before we wrap up here, we do want to talk a little bit more about. I want to give you another chance to mention your book, because the book is amazing. I've got to get a copy of this book, because I've mentioned this on some of my other shows. Like, I love the world of deep diving. Of like, if you're a fan of something, having so much of it to perm through. Like, that to me is interesting in and of itself. I've mentioned before that if, like, you know, if there's a musician that I like I have my podcast about Bob Dylan. There's 45 albums of Bob Dylan to go through, as opposed to, you know, if I was like a Jimi Hendrix fan, I got 3 records and then I'm done. I got nothing, you know. I like the idea of that. There's, you mentioned, 5,000 movies produced between this year and this year. There's so many to perm from. I mean, again, I've seen, like, you know, Duel, and I've seen, you know, Ants, and I've seen a couple others, and now this one. But so I want to, you have a chance to mention your book, but I also want to mention this other movie that's out, a TV movie called The Spell, which is out from Shout Factory on Blu-ray, and you do the audio commentary for it, which is amazing, because, like, I love audio commentaries, and I'm, like, so impressed that you got to do this. So why don't you talk about The Spell a little bit?
Okay, well, The Spell is a really interesting movie. This one has had a home video release too. It came out on VHS back in the day, and it's really nice to see that it got a Blu-ray. I did an interview with Jeff Nelson, who works at Shout Factory, who put this together. You can listen to that if you want to get like sort of Shout Factory side. But it turns out that I know Jeff online. I met him a few years ago through our love of horror films, and he used to comment a lot on a Facebook page I was running for Retro Slashers. And then I just friended him one day. I saw that his Facebook page had, like, you know, Maniac and the Golden Girls, like, you know, just in his timeline. And I'm like, oh my God, this is me. So we became friendly.
The Venn diagram of Maniac and Golden Girls is very, very slight.
Yes, that's true. And so, a couple of people actually, when he announced The Spell was coming out on Blu-ray, mentioned me to him, and he was already familiar with me, and I believe he had my book, and he thought to himself, he said, you know what, maybe she would be good for a commentary track. So we were talking about maybe having him come on to my podcast, just in general. I wasn't even pitching myself, and he said, hey, you know what, would you like to do this? So the way not podcasting, but commentary tracks work now is you can do them from almost anywhere. And so you get a lot of different people doing commentary tracks from all over the world. And some of them are all over the world doing the same commentary, like The Stereo Continues, if you're familiar with them, that podcast. They do tons and tons of commentaries, and they're located in Ireland, England, and America. And so it's a lot easier to do now. So they approach all these different people to do things. And so I got lucky that Jeff was kind of already familiar with me and that a couple people had mentioned me, and which I'm grateful for. And I should mention them. That was Bill Ackerman from Supporting Characters Podcast, and also my friend Michael Ferrari, and Ben Scher, who is the Sometimes Podcasting Partner from Retro Movie Love. And so so they just told me, they gave me a date, and they said, go ahead and do this and send it to us. And it was really, really difficult. You know, commentary tracks are a lot harder than I think people give them credit for, especially when you're by yourself. To come up, and there's not a lot of production history on the film. So I talked a lot about the subtext in the film, and I found things like how it rated in the Nielsens and what it ran against and things like that. And so I tried to provide a lot of historical context for it as well. And it came out, and I've gotten pretty good feedback on it so far. I mean, nobody, I haven't gotten a huge amount. Like, it's not like everybody's writing about, oh my God, this person did this commentary track, but I have gotten people contacting me and saying that they really enjoyed it. And so if people pick up the spell and listen to it, I do hope they enjoy it. But more importantly, I hope they pick up the spell and show Shout Factory that it's worth investing in releasing TV movies on home video, because this is sort of not necessarily, they did a tester a couple years ago. They did a double pack with, Are You in the House Alone, which is the name of my book, and also The Initiation of Sarah. And that one didn't sell quite as well as they were hoping. So they're kind of trying it out again. And I would really like to see this movie do well, because that would be encouraging for them to into more titles. And it turns out there's a couple more movies coming out. Kino Lorber is going to be releasing The Burning Bed on Blu-ray, a very important film with Farrah Fawcett. And then another company, and I can never remember who they are, is re-releasing Summer of Fear, the Wes Craven movie, which is fantastic. And I'm really excited about that release. So anyway, it just sort of happened. It was sort of like the stars aligned, and I was in the right place at the right time, and I got to do the commentary. What was so neat about it was I sent it in, and they were like, well, we have to run this by MGM. And I'm like, oh my God, that's so weird. Like, they're sending my stuff all over to the studios, and like, and it was fine. And there it is on the Blu-ray. And I don't know how often that's going to happen in my life, but I'm really excited about it.
It's amazing. I will say right now, and I'm not doing it just to you know, wax your car. I bought the Blu-ray because you did the commentary. That's why I bought it, because I like your show. You're very entertaining. And when I heard that you did a commentary, I was like, that's amazing. Because, like, I will admit, that would be, like, my dream scenario would be picked to do a commentary for, like, one of my favorite movies. And every time, you know, a movie comes out where it's, like, that I really love, and it comes out on, like, a bare-bones release, I kind of, you know, lower my head a little. I'm like, I would have done a commentary for free, you know? Like, I just would have done it. So I was so impressed that they found you to do it, and then you did it. And so it's sitting here on my desk. I haven't had a chance, because like I said, I haven't seen The Spell, so I need to watch the movie first and watch you talking over it. But I'm really excited, and I'm really thrilled for you, and I hope you get a chance to do more. I think Shout Factory is doing great stuff by releasing this. You know, they really do these deep dives, of course, for like some of their bigger movies where they get, you know, all this extra feature. But I love that they're still doing physical media, and they're finding these sort of, you know, dark corners of the home video market to release some of this stuff. So I think it's terrific. And I'm just congratulations. I'm thrilled that you got a chance to do it.
Thank you so much. Yeah, I'm thrilled too. It's really neat.
And let's end this. Let's talk about your book a little bit. Like, what was the idea of putting this together in a book? When did that get started?
Well, the book was already kind of being made when I came along. So Head Press, which is a British publisher, they had gotten some contributors, and they were building this book on made-for-TV movies. People had already submitted reviews. There were a couple of essays. And couple different people mentioned me to David Karakis, I think I'm saying that right, from Head Press. And so we started talking online, and he was like, well, this is the idea we have for the book, and blah, blah, blah. And so I was like, okay. And at that point, a lot of the big movies had already been taken, like movies I would want to write about, like Bad Ronald had been taken and things like that. And so, but you know, like I said, I really like Obscura. So I pulled some suggestions, and I said, well, I would like to write about these, and I would like to do an essay on this. And he's like, okay, yeah, that sounds good. So as it was going along, it was taking longer and longer to kind of get things together. And that's because David is, Carekeys and Headpress, it's a very small company and it's really just David. And so he said, you know, I've got all these other things on my plate. Would you like to take over and handle the book? And so I was like, oh my God, this is such an amazing opportunity. So I said, yes, of course I would love to. So, but I will say a lot of it was already in place. And I bring this up, well, because it's the truth, but also because a lot of people contacted me and were like, why didn't you ask me to be in the book? And some of them are half joking and some of them are very serious and they're upset about it. And it was like, well, you know, this book came to me and it was already, I already had like a dozen people contributing things. And a lot of the stuff had already been taken and maybe not turned in, but we had a general idea of what these people were writing and where they were going with it. And then the rest of it, I sort of tailor-made. It was so interesting. It came to me and there were a lot of movies that weren't covered in it yet, like Duel, like nobody had asked to write about Duel.
Amazing.
Yeah. And that's when I brought in Dan. And so Dan picked a couple of movies he wanted to write about himself, but he also took on like Trilogy of Terror nobody had written about.
Wow.
I've
seen that one.
Yeah, but there were all these weird movies that everybody, you know, had like somebody turned in. Oh, gosh, I can't even remember the name of it. It was with Leonard Nimoy. And it's just this weird movie that like hardly anybody's seen. And I'm glad he wrote about it. But like, the Golden Gate Murders is in there and like just these like good movies, but movies that weren't necessarily considered the classics. So, and I'm still missing movies. Like I wish I had put in Vampire with Richard Lynch, and I missed that one. And so it's still got some gaps in it. But when it came to me, I made a list of titles. Satan School for Girls wasn't in there, you know, and it was just like, these are movies that I feel like should be in there. And then I started a rolling list and it kept expanding of movies that I thought these need to be in here. And then I started thinking about essays. And at that point, Jennifer Wallace had already turned in a couple of amazing essays, but that was really it. So I thought about things I wanted to write about. And then I thought about things that might be important to write about. And I started approaching different people. Like there's a USA Original article in there. And I went to Paul Freitag Fay, who I'd done a year-long retrospective on the USA Original with him in Daily Grindhouse, because he was then the editor, I think, of that site. And I knew he knew the films really well. So I went to him. And somebody else had written some reviews about World War III and nuclear holocaust. And that's so important in the 80s, right? That was over everybody's
head. Sure.
Yeah. And he'd done these great reviews. But I thought maybe he could also write an essay as like a companion piece. So I had him do that. And so it kind of built from there. So I don't want to say that it was already done when I got it because it wasn't. But at the same time, it was already started when I came on. And so I think that's important for people to know. And it just really developed into something that I loved, and there was so much heart in it. So many people were so excited to contribute to it. And we have contributors from all over the world. People from Australia contributed, people from England contributed. And so there's a whole flavor to the book that makes it really unique, because I will tell you, now that I've been to Australia and to England to promote the book.
Wow.
And yeah, and they see TV movies as just American exports, and they don't think of them on the same level we do. They have a little bit higher respectability to me. My experience talking to people about TV movies there, and it's really neat. They see it as cinema. And so it was really nice to get some of those people contributing to the book, because the way they approached it might be different than an American writer would approach it. And there's some reviews where people didn't like the movie, and I'm a real soft critic.
Okay.
So I try to like everything, but their reviews were how they felt. And I just feel like there's a lot of interesting insight into all the films in the book, and I'm really proud of it.
Very cool. It's fantastic. I really can't wait to read it. Like I said, I like learning about this stuff, and I love the podcast. So, Amanda, thank you so much for coming on. I said, I'm a big fan of the show that you and Daniel and Nate do. I think it's a lot of fun, and I'm just thrilled for you that you got a chance to do the commentary track. That's really cool, and sort of be the sort of champion for this whole part of lost cinema. Again, I like that phrase a lot. And so, and I'm really glad I got a chance to watch Honeymoon with a Stranger. It was a fun little thriller, and we probably didn't even talk about it as much as we should have, but it's hard because there are a lot of surprises waiting for you in that movie, and it's hard to even talk about them without spoiling them. So if you're someone who enjoys that kind of thing, go to YouTube. The link will be in the show notes, and you can watch it, and you get to see Janet Leigh look fabulous throughout this whole movie. So tell people where they can find your show.
Yeah, we're at, it's called the Made for TV Mayhem Show. I think it's www.madefortvmayhempodcast.wordpress.com. But you can actually go to my blog, which is just madefortvmayhem.com, and you'll see a link to it. And the RSS feed is up, so you can see what the latest episodes are. And that'll take you there. Or you can follow me on Twitter at Made for TV Mayhem, or just go to Facebook and look up either Made for TV Mayhem or the Made for TV Mayhem Show, and you'll get the two different Facebook pages. And I'm really easy to get in touch with through my social media. I'm online all the time. and I really enjoy the community on there, especially on Twitter. I got a lot of foreign people on there that are really into TV movies. It's kind of neat. So just find me one of those methods. But I guess your best shot would be just madefortvmayhem.com.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for coming on and doing this. I really appreciate it. I had a lot
thank
of fun
you. Yeah, it was great.
All right. Well, thanks, everybody. Of course, you can find back episodes of our show over on our network site, which is fireandwaterpodcast.com. And we're always talking movies and stuff over on the Twitter side, which is at Film and Water Pod. So thanks, everybody, for listening. And until next week, that's a wrap.
Is it a crime in Spain to be wealthy?
It's a crime not to be.
Well, then, Inspector, I would appreciate it if you would ignore the gossip and the rumors and the vicious newspaper articles.
Signora, when you married Ernesto De Cardi, how long did you know him?
3 weeks.
While I never had the pleasure of meeting the gentleman, even in such remote a place as Chinchon...
I am not interested in his past. I am interested in where he is now.
As am I.
Then do something.
Your first night was, shall we say... No cause for anger or disappointment.
It was not.
So he did not leave angry. You drank a little too much champagne, so you cannot tell me if he left alone.
Inspector, do you consider 48 hours sufficient?
For what, Signora?
To find my husband, because that's how long I'll wait before going to the American Embassy.